Welcome to Heard at Heritage. Heard at Heritage features cutting-edge analysis and thought from leading experts in and across the conservative movement, as well as premier events and programming from the Heritage Foundation here in the heart of Washington, D.C., brought straight to you.
Hello and welcome back to the Power Hour, the Heritage Foundation Center for Energy, Climate, and Environments podcast. I'm your host, Jack Spencer, and I am joined today by none other than the OG, the GOAT, the one, the only, Mr. John Pott. John, how are you today?
I am fine, and I'm no GOAT. I'm a bull. Thank you very much.
GOAT, the greatest of all time. You are
I'm
the
kidding.
GOAT.
I'm kidding. I'm so invested in college basketball right now. I know what GOAT means. It's like I can't stop watching. It's crazy.
Who's your team?
Villanova, Wildcats. Right. My daughter also goes to UVA, so I'm following UVA as well in the ACC.
All right. I'm a Maryland Terps guy. Fear the Terps.
Oh, okay. You've got to run, right? You guys getting a run, right?
You don't know. I don't think. Not much this year.
I'll follow up for you. Don't worry.
But the Terps are a different conversation for a different day. Anyhow, you know what? I think spring, John, has finally sprung.
Oh, beautiful outside.
It is. I know you know this, John. I don't know if folks do, and why would they? But I generally work from home, so it's easy during the winter, as you can imagine. It's also easy during the summer because it's hot. You don't need to be outside all the time. But my God, this time of year, like right now, it is so hard to work from home. There are seeds that need planted, fish to catch. Soon there's going to be turkeys to shoot and mushrooms to forage. But to be fair, go ahead.
I was going to say there's fudge to eat as well for me. I'll explain more.
Okay. Now, I will say on the mushroom and turkey front, I'm not great at either. I don't kill many turkeys, and I don't forage many mushrooms, but I still like to go out and give it the old college try. But the point is, being at home and focusing on work is tough this time of year, but thankfully, I get to come in each week and do this podcast from here at the Heritage Studio. And while the drive is horrid, hanging out with you all for an hour is well worth it.
Amen. Amen, brother.
So, John, after being holed up throughout the winter, do you have any sort of springtime activities that you look forward to?
Well, let me get back to the candy reference about the fudge. It is my birthday on the 16th, Saturday.
Okay.
So one of my rites of spring is, depending on how it is by my birthday, is an arbiter of spring. And it's beautiful out now. So that's one of my rituals. And my sister, God bless her, sent me candy from the Ocean City, New Jersey boardwalk. So I am in hog heaven right now, sir.
All right. Now I'm going to say something that's a bit controversial.
Uh-oh.
Ocean City, New Jersey is a second tier Ocean City.
Oh, man. Wow.
As compared to Ocean City, Maryland, which is quite easily the finest vacation spot on the Eastern Seaboard, if not in the entire United States or maybe even the whole world. I'll just put that out there.
All right, now we're pals, but the gloves could come off.
Wait, man, I love Ocean City so much. I love everything about it. I love everything about it.
Anyway. Right back at you about Ocean City, New Jersey. Thank you very much.
Well, this leads us right perfect time for our housekeeping. So to remind everyone that our email address is thepowerhour@heritage.org. So you got to write into us. Are you Team Jack? Ocean City, Maryland is the quite possibly the finest vacation spot in the world. Or Team John, and you like that other lesser Ocean City.
You stab right at my heart, friend.
or you can let us know what you think about the podcast otherwise, or what issues you want to hear us talk about, what you think of what we're doing, what we should do different or better or worse. Just write to me. As I tell you all the time, I get lonely. I work from home. So emails from y'all, I respond to each of them. Some of them lead to show ideas. So let me know what you're thinking. I really appreciate it. John, now, why don't you let people know where they can find us?
Just look for Heard at Heritage, The Power Hour. It's the Power Hour podcast. We're on all platforms, Apple Podcasts, Ricochet, Spotify, you name it, we are there. And please subscribe and share.
Yes. That way, once you subscribe, you don't even have to remember where we are. We just like pop up in your whatever podcast pop up at.
We're like a fungus. We're just there. Yes.
We were just there. Now, John, you know I like nuclear energy.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, I think it's fair to say we spend a decent amount of time here at the Power Hour talking nuclear.
Yep.
Now, I have a bit of a confession to make here. It's, I don't know if it's a confession, more of a heads up. Over the next few weeks, we're going to be going hard on nuclear. And we have some awesome, awesome guests lined up.
Good.
I'm talking president type, not presidents of the United States, president company, you know, heads of company types.
Right, right.
Real technology and policy leaders. We're not just going to be talking about why nuclear is awesome or safe or whatever. We've covered all that. We all know it's safe. We all know it's awesome. Whatever. We get that. But we're going to go a little bit deeper into some discrete issue areas. We're going to bring in some real experts, some people who can provide some real insight. Not that our past guests haven't, but we're going to go a little bit deeper. And I promise you that today is going to be a banger of an episode, as the kids like to say.
Excellent.
Now, there are two things you know, I think you know, that I like, if nothing else, in this world. And those two things are free and markets. And those likes inform my perspective on energy policy, including nuclear energy policy. We all know that. Well, the problem, of course, is virtually no one else, at least in this godforsaken city of Washington, D.C., populated by the grifters, rent seekers, do-gooders who think they know better how to spend your money than you do, who think we'd all be better off if we conform to their preferences rather than our own. Virtually no one agrees with me.
Oh.
But notice that I said virtually no one.
Right.
That means that there might be someone. And indeed, there is at least one. And guess what, John?
Yes.
He is here with us today.
Oh, I mean, other than me.
Other than you. I mean, I know you. Other than you. We have that at least one other person.
Excellent.
Now, I'm not going to suggest that he agrees with me on everything. Or even even that he would characterize Washington like I just did. I don't want to put that. He doesn't need that kind of heat. But I do know that he not only supports nuclear energy, but he has dedicated his professional life to it. And he's not one of those armchair experts who likes telling other people how to spend their time and their money. He is the president and chief technologist of an actual nuclear company.
Mm.
And he has experienced firsthand the challenges of being a nuclear company and having to engage with government and the problems that poses and maybe the opportunities we can ask him. Most importantly to me, he's a longtime friend of mine. I've known him probably over 10 years, I'd say. Long time, at least in professional terms. We've literally spent hours talking about these issues over the years. He's a brilliant dude. He's innovative. He's a little bit iconoclastic, but I'll call him that. He doesn't need to call himself that. He knows the technology, the history, the business. It is with great pleasure that I welcome to the Power Hour, Flybe Energy's Kirk Sorensen. Kirk, welcome to the Power Hour.
Thank you so much, Jack. I really appreciate it.
Well, I really appreciate you being here today. You're someone that I respect as much, probably more, I'll just say more than other people in the nuclear industry space. You're a great dude. You know what you're talking about. And you're not afraid to sort of question the narrative sounds tinfoil hatty, but you're not afraid to question sort of the way we do things in a respectful way. So I've always appreciated your insight because, you know, I share that sort of, I don't want to say I have skepticism over the way things are being done, and I appreciate your willingness to talk with me about why my skepticism may or may not be well-founded. So thank you for that. We'll get that. We'll get that out of there. But let's talk. I want to talk about you first. One of the things we do here at the Power Hour is I try to introduce the audience to the guest so they know that I'm not lying about who you are. So, Kirk, how did you get into nuclear energy? What made you a nuke guy?
it's all the fault of space. You know, I really wanted to do space stuff, and out there we can't burn things, so we needed nuclear energy. So that's how I got into nuclear.
So you used to be in aerospace.
Yeah. I was a space guy. I just loved all that kind of stuff. Loved Star Wars and Star Trek when I was a kid. Thought about space, dreamed about space, imagined space. And it was pretty clear that we weren't going to go anywhere in space unless we had nuclear energy. It was just about the only option once you got further away from the sun.
And we actually, that's a technology that's in use now, or sort of in we use nuclear energy in space now for propulsion. Is that right? Or for certain power?
We use nuclear decay energy to heat and provide limited power to certain spacecraft in very extreme conditions. But we make almost no use of nuclear fission in space activities. And that was how I got started originally.
I'm gonna ask you stuff that some things I've never talked to you about before. I didn't already. The conversation is going off from where I had originally thought. On this space nuclear thing, do you know? And I believe it's the case. During the Cold War, there were plans to use fission for certain propulsion systems in space, and they were designed but not built. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, they were even going as far back as Wernher von Braun and Ernst Stuhlinger in the 1950s. They were imagining how we were going to use nuclear powered spacecraft to go to Mars. Disney did a great video called Mars and Beyond, where Stuhlinger extols his notions of how we would use nuclear reactors to power ion engines to send astronauts to Mars. And this was all even before we launched the first person into space. So this goes pretty far back.
Now, from your technical background, are all of those things at least theoretically possible?
Yeah, they are theoretically possible. I definitely have my own directions on that I think are most promising. But yeah, that was how things got started for me. And also things like powering facilities on the surface of the moon. You know, the moon is orbiting the Earth once a month, and it goes into 2 weeks of darkness. And just recently, we've seen landers land on the moon that have, you know, worked for a few days, but then they've gone into that darkness period. And they never come out again. They try to signal them 2 weeks later, and they're dead. And they just get so cold, everything freezes up, and the thing dies. So having nuclear energy is really significant if you want to go and do things on the moon, on Mars, and in deep space. You're going to have to get into that.
These car batteries just can't get away from the underlying problem that they don't work well in cold weather, even on the moon.
Yeah. Especially if they have to run for 2 weeks, it's almost heat is a bigger problem than power. But this is why we sent our more recent Mars rovers with a nuclear decay battery powered by plutonium-238. And it worked like a charm. The heat from that plutonium battery enabled them to stay warm during the cold Martian night and work for years and years and years. So it was a big advantage to go to a nuclear battery rather than the solar panels we used to use.
That's incredibly interesting. I could talk to you about that literally for the whole hour, but I won't, because I know we have other things to talk about. All right. We know about you. You started in the aerospace industry. That sort of pushed you towards nuclear. And I think I got the verbiage here right, but I'm going to, hopefully I don't get this wrong. And you started a company, right?
Yeah. About 10 years went by from when I learned about molten salt nuclear reactors and when I actually started FLIBE Energy in 2011. But
so FLIBE Energy is the company that you started and you're currently the president of.
Yes.
So tell us about FLIBE.
So FLIBE Energy is built around, we want to realize these molten salt reactors, and particularly we want to use the thorium fuel cycle in molten salt reactors. And it's really based on technology that I learned about in my early days at NASA that was done at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee in the 1960s. And it was like technology that felt like it had been torn out of the 21st century and stitched in back in the 1960s. And it has a fascinating story dating back to an effort to build a nuclear-powered aircraft that was kind of a crazy and bad idea, but nevertheless drove technology intensely and brought about this revolutionary concept of a molten salt reactor that had so many performance and safety and economy advantages that when I learned about it in 2000, it had been sort of dead and buried for 25 years, but I was just like, why are we not doing this? And I was convinced there must be some part of the story I didn't understand. So that motivated me to pursue further nuclear study and to get another master's degree in nuclear engineering. And a lot of that, led to forming Five Energy in 2011.
All right. So I got three questions that I want to pose to you. First, why FLIBE? Like, what does FLIBE mean? That's FLIBE.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question. FLIBE's a little bit of a nerdy name. FLIBE is a thing. It's a salt mixture that the Oak Ridge boys came up with back in the 50s. It stands for the atomic symbols for fluorine, lithium, and beryllium. So they realized that there was this combination of lithium fluoride salt and beryllium fluoride salt. And if they put it together, it had really attractive features. And so they built nuclear reactors there around this FLIBE salt. And FLIBE's kind of a magic material because it can hold an enormous amount of energy. It's very chemically stable and it's impervious to radiation damage. So, not a lot of people knew what the word meant when I named the company after it, but I continue to like it. I think it's just kind of a wink and a nod to those who know what a molten salt reactor is to name the company after the molten salt of the future.
And just to clarify, those Oak Ridge boys are not the ones who famously sang the country hit Elvira.
No,
or were they the same ones? Because that would have been awesome.
Wouldn't it have been cool if it had been? Wouldn't that have been cool?
I was going to say, they're one of my favorite bands. I'm so excited.
I was so close to doing the famous part of that song where the deep-voiced singer makes does that. I'm not even going to say it, but people who know the song will know what I'm talking about. But I thought I would avoid being an embarrassment to my company and my family, and I'll just move on and not sing that for everyone. Question number two, moving right along. Question number two, what is molten salt? Like tell us quickly, real quickly, when we think of a regular reactor or a light water reactor, what that is and how molten salt is different.
Yeah, we don't look at water and say, wow, that's molten ice. But that's a way to think about it. You take salt, regular salt that we have at home, sodium chloride, and you heat it up really hot, over 1,100 degrees Celsius, and it'll melt into a liquid. Now, trust me, you don't want to touch it or be too close to it because it'll burn you. But it's very chemically stable. And these guys realized there were other salts they could make, not necessarily out of chlorides, but out of fluorides, and they could mix them up, and they would have much lower melting temperatures and much more attractive nuclear properties. But what they all had in common was this remarkable degree of chemical stability. They were just really, really stable, and the nature of their chemical bonds to one another made them impervious to radiation damage. And for those who are chemically oriented, that's because they're ionically bonded rather than covalently bonded. So molten salts have tremendous potential as the medium in which you want to do a nuclear reaction.
And that's opposed to different from a light water reactor that uses water
uses ceramic fuel, uses oxide fuel, uses fuel that's more akin to like the bricks of your fireplace. Uses fuel that you don't want to melt because by the time it melts, it'll be melting at 2,500 degrees C or so. So it's just a completely different approach to say, I want a fuel that is going to melt into a liquid that I can pump around versus I want a fuel that I really, really do not want it to melt under any circumstances. So I would look at it as like, we've got oxide fuel and today's reactors, we're talking about fluoride fuel in these future reactors.
Okay. And you touch on this, but I want to ask the question specifically because I suspect that most people listening aren't technical experts. So can you explain to us what the safety benefits are of the molten salt technology?
Yeah, it's really simple in that we need to get the salt hot in order to get it to melt. And if it cools down, it's going to freeze up again. So we basically put a drain in the bottom of the molten salt reactor, and we keep it plugged by a plug of frozen salt. And we keep that salt frozen by actively cooling it externally somehow, some fan, some coolant loop, something or not, something that we're intentionally doing. The whole idea is that if we stop intentionally doing that, if the power goes out, if, you know, somebody walks away, if, you know, anything goes wrong, then it's just going to melt, and it's just going to drain this molten salt bathtub into another tank where it can be passively cooled indefinitely. And that's really, really, really nice. And also the fact these salts, they're running at atmospheric pressure. So they're not running at high pressure. So even if you punched a hole in the outside of the vessel, nothing's going to come spewing out. It's just in there like in a tub. But in today's reactors, we're running solid fuel with a coolant, generally water, under very high pressure. And if that pressure boundary is breached, if there's a loss of pressure, that water is going to flash into steam. That steam is 1,000 times less dense than liquid water, and it's not going to cool that oxide fuel. And then you could get a situation where the oxide fuel can melt. And at the temperatures at which oxide fuel melts, it can and could melt through the vessels that are containing it. The temperature at which molten salt melts is 1,000 degrees below the temperature at which the vessel containing it would melt. So, you know, the stuff's just going to drain out. So it's very, very passively safe.
What does the fission process look like in your in molten salt versus the reactors that are generally running commercially in the United States? Like, you know, those are, for folks that don't know, the fuel is solid, the fission takes place inside that solid fuel. As the fission takes place, it releases heat. There are processes that take place that change the nature of that fuel, but it still generally looks the same once it's done. It's still these hard pellets of ceramic fuel. But
yep,
that's
exactly.
That's not what a molten salt reactor does. Like, how does that, what does it look like? Like, how do you fuel it? What goes in? What comes out? Like, what's the deal with that?
Yeah, the most fundamental difference is in today's ceramic reactors with water cooling, the fuel and the coolant are two separate fluids. The fuel, like you said, it's heating up from fission, and then it's conducting that energy into the coolant, which is outside of the fuel. It's on the other side of a zirconium cladding. So you got to make sure that energy, that thermal power, is conducted into the coolant in all circumstances. In the molten salt, you have dissolved uranium or thorium fuel into the salt itself. So the energy of fission is born in the coolant, like it materializes, mm-hmm. you know, in the coolant itself. So there's no process where that fission thermal energy has to move from a fuel into a coolant. It's born in the coolant. So the coolant heats up readily from the fission process. And as you pump this molten salt around, as you pump it through a loop, it's just like, you know, the salt will heat up in the core, it'll go out of the core, it'll go through a heat exchanger, it'll heat up your working fluid, then it'll go back in again for another round. So it's a much more direct process of heating your coolant than what we do in today's water and ceramic fuel reactors.
And how do you fuel it? Do you put like a certain amount of the fuel in there, and it goes through the process for some period of time, then you empty the reactor and refill it? Or is it an ongoing process where you are somehow draining off the used fuel and putting more in? What does that look like?
Yeah, that's another real beauty of the entire process, is the fact that we can add fuel as the machine is running. And that's nearly impossible to do in a solid fueled reactor. You've got to put it in, run it for 18 months or so, and take it out. With this fuel, we can add more nuclear fuel to the molten salt as it's running, and we can also remove the products of fission from the fuel as it is running. That way we don't turn the machine off for refueling. Refueling, one way to look at it is refueling is happening all the time. Another way to look at it is refueling is never happening. You know, both can be defended. That to me alone is just a huge advantage over what we do today, because when we shut our reactors down, that's a big scheduling problem and things that, that grid operators have to work around a month or 6 week shutdown for a nuclear reactor to say, hey, you know what? We got to do that anymore. We got a reactor that can just run. I think they would just love that.
And then what does the waste look like? Both physically, what does it look like? But also chemically, what does it look like?
Well, this gets into some details of what we want to do. Specifically, what we want to do is we want to run a circuit inside the molten salt, very akin to a battery, where we would deposit the products of fission onto a cathode, probably different products of fission. And then these could be partitioned and usefully put to work. By contrast, today's solid-fueled reactors, they only use up a small fraction of the energy potential of their fuel before the fuel is removed. The vast majority of what remains in the ceramic fuel is unburned uranium, but there's a little bit of fission products, a few percent, and there's a little bit of products that have formed when the uranium fuel did not fission, but rather absorb the neutron and form things like plutonium. So you've got a melange of things in today's nuclear reactors, most of which aren't waste. And that right, can be largely avoided.
Okay, so, and to extract those useful materials, there are processes to do that. France does it, for example, with a process called Purex, where they break down that fuel, put it through a number of chemical processes, and then pull out the usable uranium and plutonium and remanufacture new fuel from the old fuel. And that's a perfectly fine process, but it's very expensive, very capital intensive. And I would argue, at least until and unless we build a bunch of new reactors, there's not a real good business case for, because there's uranium fuel out there to use. But nonetheless, that's in a very simplistic way, the way that can be achieved somewhat with current reactors, and that we don't do that at all in the United States. In the United States, the federal government took control over nuclear waste management in 1982 and has done absolutely nothing with it, and it currently sits on the sites of nuclear power plants safely, but that's where it sits and nothing really is done with it. How is that different,
Jack,
from your
okay so I might shock you here. I actually think the federal government made the right decision back then for the wrong reasons. They did it because of concerns about proliferation, but the way that France is dealing with their spent fuel is fabulously expensive and really doesn't buy them very much. I think we, by not doing that, ended up saving ourselves a lot of money. We should use our spent fuel, but I don't think we should try to recycle it back into our existing reactors. I think the move forward is to take our spent fuel and to recycle it forward into molten salt reactors, and that can be achieved for a tiny fraction of the cost of the Purex process they pursue in France, with far more ultimate benefit. So I do think, so I want to parse that idea a little bit. I think we should do something about spent fuel, but I also think we made the right choice not going with a big program of Purexing our fuel.
All right, so now I'm going to put in my two cents. Because as you know, Kirk, this is my all-time favorite issue. I don't disagree with you. Well, I totally agree with you. No, how do I put this? I don't disagree with you that would make more sense. I, though, from a policy standpoint, don't like to judge one way or the other what someone should do with the nuclear fuel. I think that I think the mistake that was made was not by government, not by the federal government to build Yako or not to build a Purex plant or not to build any other facility. It was the mistake in 1982 of Congress taking the responsibility for nuclear waste management away from the private sector. That was the mistake. And the private sector should determine how it's dealt with and whether that's Purex or molten salt reactors. And in a real competition where the waste producers are responsible for waste management, the most economical, the best processes will emerge victorious. And that's how that should have been determined. I would just put out there.
And I agree with that. you know, I wonder, had that been put forward in 1982, if we would have taken a better approach. I don't know. It was a very confusing time that I've studied a lot, trying to figure out, you know, why were decisions made the way they were then based on what they knew then.
Well, I think, you know, one of the interesting things one of the interesting things I think about that time is that I don't know what we would have done what anyone would have done, because the nuclear industry was very much on the decline then. And I think that part of the thinking was the federal government may as well do this because we're not going to build a bunch of reactors. We just need a place to put the waste that our existing fleet has produced and will produce. And that's why Yucca Mountain has the 150,000 ton limit, because that's essentially how much waste would have been produced by by our existing reactors if they worked throughout their lifetime. And so I don't think that there was really any innovative thinking around nuclear waste, because there was not really a future. I think that I don't think most people thought there was really a future for industry. But that's the problem that politicians always make, is that whenever they start planning, they screw things up, and they began planning and they screwed things up. They don't allow for innovation or changes in the market or whatever the case is. And that's why I think energy policy is one of the worst kinds of policy, because energy markets are robust and they function best when left alone. And that's just a great example of government distorting energy markets and it resulting in complete failure. If we were never to build new nuclear energy, then you still would have a market for doing something with the existing waste. Anyway, that's the way I look at it, and that's why I think that decision was made, in addition to the proliferation concerns that were stated, though I agree they were not real concerns.
Well, can I throw a few more thoughts into that stew of thoughts?
Absolutely.
So in 1982, you hadn't had a new nuclear plant ordered for quite a while. But to my surprise, when I went back and looked when most nuclear plants were commissioned, we probably only had about one third of our plants built at that point. So right. A lot of nuclear plants were under construction at the time and would come online in the remainder of the 80s and even into the early 90s. Watts Bar 1, I don't think finished until about 93 or 94. I can't quite remember. So I think the industry was going to the government and saying, look, you're telling us you don't want to build fast breeder reactors. You don't want us to go refabricate this waste into fuel for fast breeder. What's your plan? And if you don't want us doing that, we need somewhere for the fuel to go. And I think that's where the 1982 Nuclear Waste Policy Act came from, was from an industry that was looking at this almost deluge of reactors that were still yet to come online and suddenly going, oh my gosh, we have no fuel strategy. We built these reactors under the assumption of one plan, and now that plan is completely shot and we don't know what's coming. So there, yeah. Well, you know, we didn't build any reactors until Vogtle 3 and 4 that were ordered after 1973. But in 1982, most of those reactors still hadn't been finished or come online yet.
Other than Watts Bar 2.
Watts Bar 2 was ordered in 1973.
I know, but it came online in 2000. And
yeah, in 2014 or so, yeah. Watts Bar 2 came online. So, yeah.
But your point 100% still stands. Yeah, look, I agree with all that. But in another wrinkle in all of that, yeah, it is true what you said that, you know, maybe a third of reactors had been built. It's also true that only half of the reactors that were planned were built, because there was about 200 that they wanted to build, you know, whenever the initial plans for building reactors were being made. 100 of them never got built. The other thing, is that natural gas then was so cheap. It became very cheap very quick. So you had this coming together of the regulatory burden growing, of the anti-nuclear movement gaining momentum, the anti-nuclear weapons movement transitioning toward and engulfing the anti-nuclear energy movement. And then the natural gas prices all coming together. And that's why I think part of it was the part of the Yucca decision, the decision for the federal government to take the nuclear waste and to do something with it, because they didn't think there was a future. And they essentially were able to finish 100 of them But that's not near what they thought they would otherwise be able to do.
Yeah, and here in North Alabama, I mean, we really see the remnants of that non-build-out you're talking about. I mean, there's Bellefonte 1 and 2, which I see all the time when I drive to Chattanooga. That's an almost completed reactor. Yellow Creek 1 and 2, which were built on the Alabama side of Mississippi. There's Hartsville 1, 2, 3, and 4. There's Phipps Bend 1 and 2. There's the Clinch River Breeder reactor. Those were just TVA reactors that were not built. So that was far more reactors that were not built than were built just in the TVA fleet. I mean, I'm not 100% sure about the natural gas thing. I think natural gas didn't really get cheap until the late 90s, early 2000s. But when I was really kind of modeling what happened in the 80s, because we didn't build all these reactors, as you mentioned, what I saw was two things. We built a lot of coal. We built a lot of coal. Big coal plants came online across the country. And then we retained a lot of coal. Many coal plants that had been built in the 40s, 50s, what would have been potentially decommissioned were not decommissioned and instead were retained much longer. I wrote a blog post a long time ago called the TVA that might have been after the Kingston coal ash spill. And it showed how had TVA finished out their nuclear reactor fleet, they could have retired just about all of their coal plants in the 1990s and been a nearly carbon-free energy fleet. Instead, they retained those coal plants well into the 2000s, and only in the last few years have they really started aggressively shutting them down, but without the major baseload of these nuclear plants to pick up the slack from them.
I think just to close the natural gas point, I'm almost positive. I don't have the numbers in front of me. I can check it out and update folks on the next podcast. But I think natural gas did fall in price in the early 80s, and that in the late. Certainly the early 80s, and that led to changes in energy markets. But I'll come back to that, Kirk, and you'll just have to trust that I appropriately address it later on. But I wanted to move into a discussion about nuclear's future. But before I do that, and I didn't know that our conversation would go here, we talked about a minute ago the bunch of orders that were never carried out in the 70s. I guess those orders were done in the 70s, not carried out in the 80s. But that happened again after the 2005 Energy Policy Act. A very similar, though on a different scale, thing happened where we had, I think, 32 reactors that companies had submitted some one kind of plan or another to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to build. There was some substantial interest in building those, and they all went away except for two, and not unlike some of the ones that you were mentioning that litter where you're from, there were two more in South Carolina that they started building, and they had to stop. My fears were going down that same road. I'm curious what your thoughts are on maybe mistakes that were made after 2005, which just so people remember, there was a lot of bipartisan support for nuclear energy in the mid-2000s for any number of reasons, though not, I wouldn't say it's as strong as it is today, but it was there. The federal government put forth a bunch of subsidies to allegedly kickstart the nuclear industry, and the industry responded by submitting a whole bunch of applications to build new reactors. A whole lot of plans were put forth at the utility level to build new reactors. But a nuclear renaissance, it never became. And so I see that same playbook unfolding. I'm curious, Kirk, your thoughts on, is that the case? Is it different this time? I don't know. What are your thoughts on those words I just spoke?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up. And I'm glad for this larger conversation, because I think understanding the history of what has happened is absolutely essential to making the right calls going forward. You cannot make proper decisions if you haven't really spent time understanding how we got to where we are and what happened and what didn't happen. So let's jump forward to 2005, to the Energy Policy Act of 2005. A couple of things had changed in 2005. You know, we were still in the midst of engagements in the Middle East. Natural gas was not cheap. It was quite expensive. You had a lot of proposals for coal plants. In fact, there were 100 new coal plants, 100 gigawatts of coal plants proposed at that same time, and they were all canceled too. And you had a lot of nuclear plants proposed. But there was a difference between what had happened in the 70s and 80s versus what happened in 2005. Almost all of those plants that were proposed in that second renaissance were on existing sites. There might be one or two exceptions, but I think the vast majority of those were, you know, second or third units on existing sites. There was also the promise that we were going to use a new regulatory structure in the NRC called Part 52 that was going to really, really make it easier for those plants to come online. And that still remains a great point of controversy, whether or not that was true. I just heard a really great podcast recently by James Krellenstein, who certainly changed a lot of my thoughts about this. But the biggest one I see, though, is you just had this big cost barrier towards natural gas, and you also had this tsunami of coal plants, because now all those old coal plants I was mentioning were to be replaced. And so these new coal plants were going to go in. And there was a huge pushback against that from the I hate to even call them the environmentalists, but the left really said, you know, no, we're not going to have new coal plants. And by the way, we're not going to have new nuclear plants either. And still, it was going, but we hit the financial crisis of 2008. Everything went topsy-turvy. But the biggest thing of all was we hit Fukushima in 2011. And suddenly you had 50 Japanese reactors go offline, which I would have never predicted that kind of response from the Japanese, to turn off their entire fleet and then to leave it off. And you had a gusher of uranium, because suddenly there were all these reactors that weren't ordering uranium anymore. They weren't ordering enrichment services. Both those costs went to the floor for uranium and uranium enrichment, which should have helped nuclear. But the bigger thing was natural gas was $2 a million BTU. And at $2 a million BTU, oh my goodness. And the GE and others had gotten so good at building cheap natural gas plants. I mean, I went to one at Langley Gulch outside of Boise, $300 million, 3 years to build it, and three people running it. And I thought, good heck, I don't think a nuclear plant is ever going to come close to these kind of economics, being able to call up GE and say, plug in a natural gas plant. So we've had in the last 10 years this huge shift from coal to natural gas. And remember, all those coal plants, those 100 coal plants I was talking about, they did not get built. They did not come online. One of the only plants I can think of that did come online was the Comanche 3 plant outside Pueblo. But vast majority of those new coal plants did not come to be. And of the nuclear plants, one last point I wanted to make was almost none of those plants broke ground. They had, you know, interest, they were putting applications in, but the only plants that broke ground were Vogtle 3 and 4 and Summer 2 and 3. Nobody else broke ground. And Summer 2 and 3 got canceled.
Right. No, but yes, that's all correct. So that leads us to now, where I feel like there's this groundswell of support for nuclear energy. There's at least rhetorical, bipartisan rhetorical support for nuclear energy. I question whether or not the real support is actually there, and if there's not other reasons for some people to support it. But I share your
uncertainty. And Jack, can I just make one more point that I think?
Okay,
we talked about how there was a plan for spent nuclear fuel. In 2005, there was another plan that was resurrected called Global Nuclear Energy Partnership, or GNEP. This was the DOE saying, okay.
Do you remember what it was called before that? Just right before the original name?
What was it called?
GENIE, the Global Nuclear Energy Initiative. And no one liked GENIE, so they changed it to GNEP.
But the idea of GNEP was basically it was Clinch River Breeder Reactor all over again. We accepted that Yucca 1 was going to be full of our spent fuel, but there was not going to be a Yucca 2. So we were going to have fast breeder reactors, again, that were going to take our spent fuel and, you know, run it in fast reactors, make plutonium, burn plutonium, et cetera, but address it. So GNEP sprang into existence right around the same time with the same promise before. And as GNEP collapsed, I think you saw, again, another collapse of the initiative. So once again, waste and nuclear development were tied together and collapsed together.
And it sets everything back. It creates the narrative. Maybe it maybe it's not a narrative. Maybe it supports the reality, though I don't believe this to be true, that nuclear just always costs more than what they think it's going to and always costs too much. And it's just too expensive. Now, I don't think that's the case. I think it will always be the case so long as the industry is driven by government, because government just does not do a good job of planning and executing large-scale economic decisions. It doesn't do that well. That's why we have a free market capitalist system. That's why free markets and capitalism work so well, because it rejects the idea that government can do those things. So that brings us to nuclear. I'd like to now, as we sort of come to the last portion of this conversation, Kirk, talk to you about where do free markets and nuclear fit in? Can nuclear exist without taxpayer support? And I'd be interested in your thoughts on like the whole kickstart issue. But over the long term, my view is if any industry is not sustainable absent taxpayer support, then it's not sustainable. Not only is it not sustainable, that it makes the country weaker over time because you're continuously plowing additional taxpayer resources, which is money that was produced by the labor and productive activity of America's citizens and reapplied to something that can't exist in that same way, that it needs taxpayer subsidy to exist. So can nuclear be sustainable? Can it exist without taxpayer subsidy? What do we need to do to get there?
Yeah, great question. And I agree with everything you said there. My short answer, to paraphrase Star Trek, is it's life, Jim, but not as we know it. You know, our future for nuclear is bright, but it's not as we know it. I have said for many years now that Vogtle 3 and 4 would be the last gigawatt scale PWRs we ever build. I stand by that. I don't think we're ever going to see those in the United States again. Where they are going forward in other countries, again, it's under massive government support, whether China, France, Europe, et cetera. It's not going to happen in the United States. We're not going to build it. Enough utility executives saw other utility executives perp walked into jail to go, no, I'm not going to do that. No way. So we're not going to have nuclear based on PWRs anymore. Our PWRs are going to age and they're going to shut down. The good news is there is a beautiful strategy that will segue us from PWRs into molten salt reactors in a way that's going to transform our ability to make nuclear energy. It's going to increase it from 100 gigawatts to 1,000 gigawatts. It's going to relieve us of a nuclear waste burden. It's going to reduce our draw on the environment. We're going to be mining much less material in the future. We at FLIBE have come up with a strategy to repower this nation on nuclear that if we turned off all the uranium mining and the enrichment today, it wouldn't disrupt that strategy. What we do need access, though, to is the spent fuel. The spent fuel is a secret to getting us to the nuclear future. Our ability to go and productively disposition the materials and the spent fuel, in some cases reusing them, in some cases partitioning them, but going forward with that material in fleets of molten salt reactors of successive generations to get to where we want to get to, which is a sustainable, safe, clean, compact energy future that treads very lightly on the environment. You know, I've gone into environmentalist groups and I said, look, I want the same things you want, all right? I want clean air, I want clean water, I want a human footprint of energy that is minimized. And what we're talking about today with wind and solar is not that goal, y'all, and I think you know it. And generally they'll kind of nod their heads, yeah, wind and solar are not friends of the environment. You've seen even documentaries like Planet of the Humans where people on the left are questioning that narrative that wind and solar is the answer, and they're saying it doesn't look like it. So, you know, I think nuclear has the opportunity to be the answer to everybody, but right now it's sort of like the thing that Republicans and Democrats agree on, but nobody seems to be enthusiastic about. And I counter that pessimism with, if all I knew was pressurized water reactors, I wouldn't be optimistic about it either. But I know that there's this technology that makes all these things possible, and we've got to go forward with it.
So FLIBE's reactor, you're saying it doesn't need nuclear waste. Like, You could go off and build a reactor without nuclear waste, but the waste becomes an important part of your initial economics. Is that right? Because you're providing an important service, the disposition of waste, and you're able to use that to produce a sellable item, electricity, and then the other isotopes or I guess it's isotopes of that, that you're able to pull out of it. Is that sort of how it would work?
Yeah, let me kind of focus on that a little more. We can build nuclear reactors that don't have to run on nuclear waste. They can run on other fuels. But if we believed that the will was there from the federal government to productively do something about spent nuclear fuel, if we also believed that there was going to be a reward from the $50 billion spent nuclear fund for doing this, in other words, if I can tackle 50% of your problem, I can have 50% of the money. And if I can tackle 90% of your problem, I can have 90% of the money, kind of a thing.
Right.
Then, yeah, we would go forward in a very big way on this. Right now, though, the federal government says thou shalt not touch the spent fuel. Thou shalt not do anything with the spent fuel. And you're left asking yourself, well, what's your plan? Well, we don't have a plan, but you can't do any other plan. And you're like, well, and this is my challenge as a free marketeer is to go and say the market already got disrupted by the creation of the spent fuel fund. It exists. It's got a pile of money in it. And we have this problem. There has to be some type of decision between private sector and the federal government about paths forward, or the stalemate will just continue and perpetuate. Unless you think we're bad, everybody else almost has exactly the same problem. Japan, Korea, Mexico, England, you name it. Everybody's dealing with the same issue.
Let me ask you something, Kirk, and if you might not be able to answer this, so but I'm going to just ask you anyway. Could you dispose of all of the fuel that's been created that has nuclear waste fund money attached to it for the amount of money in the nuclear waste fund? In other words, just so people know, let me provide a little bit of background to that question. Whenever utilities produce nuclear waste or produce nuclear energy, a small fee is passed on to the consumer, one-tenth of 1 cent, called a mill, is passed on to the consumer. That money is collected as nuclear energy is produced and sent to this nuclear waste fund. And so the nuclear waste fund is like $60 billion, something like that right now. But
$50 billion. I just checked in the DOE appropriation yesterday.
Okay. $50 billion. $50 billion, but that doesn't include all the nuclear waste that's been produced, because there was a lawsuit a number of years ago that said the Department of Energy has completely failed in its legal obligation to take the waste. So the utilities haven't had to collect it for a number of years. And then in addition to that, there were a couple of utilities who made a deal that they didn't have to pay into the nuclear waste fund, but they would pay it all at once there was a once there was a deal made. So the $50 billion is not representative of all the nuclear waste, but it's representative of much of the nuclear waste. Now my question, for $50 billion, Kirk, could you take care of all the waste that's attached to that money?
Absolutely. I could do it for a quarter of that, and I would do it for
You don't say that.
Not only could we do it for a quarter of that, we could turn what is right now a $50 billion liability into a multi-trillion dollar asset that would keep producing for the United States for millions of years in the future. And yes, millions of years in the future. I can do that. I know how to
do it. All right. That's great. But here, take some advice from your old pal, Jack. Whenever the Department of Energy comes knocking on your door and says, can you do this? We have $50 billion. Here's your answer. I think, according to our calculations, it would take at least $100 billion. But for you, Department of Energy, we're going to do our best for the whole 50. That's the way it works, Kirk.
I'm limited in this by knowing that, much like the Social Security Trust Fund, the nuclear waste fund is a virtual thing. It is an IOU.
That's true.
I, as a taxpayer, would like to go back to the government and say, I'm going to solve your problem for a lot less than you've set aside for it. Because I know you don't really have $50 billion sitting in a vault anymore. This is an IOU that you have taken from the taxpayer. So as a taxpayer, I'd really like to save a lot of money on this and create incredible value from it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Jack, you got to help me on this, because I don't know, and I've been after this for a long time. I don't know how to crack this nut.
No, I know.
Politically.
I got it. Look, in all seriousness, this has been my plan. This has been what my recommendation essentially has been forever, which is what the DOE needs to do is put a request for proposal out and says, I have $50 billion. Who's going to take this waste? And they will have competition for that waste. That's all you have to do, including, I think, the folks from Nevada would be calling up and say, oh, you got $50 billion that you're willing to write a check over the next 10 years for? Here's the other thing with that $50 billion. You can write $1 billion a year off of that, and it lasts forever. That's another way they could do it. There's a million ways to use that $50 billion.
The interest alone would fund this, and yet the exact opposite is happening to any policy person out there who might listen to this at some point. They are not only not doing this, they are preventing this from happening.
Which is why, and it comes back to what we talked about 40 minutes ago, why it was such a screw up for the federal government to take control of it. Because whether we like it or not, most politicians, not all, but most are spineless. They're political animals. They don't want to subject themselves to any risk, any political risk. And when they think about nuclear energy, it's all political risk. There's no political upside to doing anything on nuclear waste. As soon as they touch it, they make themselves a political liability. And because no one has made, everyone is made whole in this, except for the taxpayer. So the Department of Energy fails in its obligations to meet the waste management obligations, but they don't lose any funding over it. The taxpayer has to pay through the judgment fund. The taxpayer, you and I pay the listeners for the Department of Energy not fulfilling its obligation. Companies, innovative companies like Kirk's and others, they pay for it because there's no real competition for the services that they could provide. Everyone pays for it because of this decision, and the whole industry, I would argue, has been thwarted because of it. These are the changes that need to be made if we actually want to have a nuclear renaissance. Kirk, what do you say to that?
You're absolutely right. I mean, I would pin the blame very, very squarely on exactly one group. That's the Department of Energy. I mean, and here's something I just find fascinating, Jack. You know, when I wander around Capitol Hill and I talk to various congressionals, this is 100% agreement on this. Like, it doesn't matter if I'm going into a Democrat or Republican. It doesn't matter if I got Ted Cruz and Bernie Sanders sitting next to each other. 100% of congressional, anybody that I've ever talked to wants to see something done about nuclear waste. I can't think of a single other policy where there's such utter uniformity on please take action. They may not agree exactly how it is to be done, but there is 100% agreement that something is to be done. So I look at this and I just go, how on earth is the Department of Energy, A, not doing anything, and B, preventing those who want to do something from doing something when all of the people in power want something done? I cannot understand it.
Kirk, we got to bring this conversation to an end. I have like 10 topics I wanted to talk to you about. I wanted to talk to you about how finance works in nuclear. I wanted to talk to you about insurance and how insurance and liability works. I wanted to talk to you about the prospect of consortiums pushing the industry forward, all these things. I'm going to ask you right now. I hope you would agree to come back at some future point.
Let's do it again. Let's do it three times if we need to.
That's great. You were a great guest. This was the best conversation I've had in a long time. Kirk, thank you so much for being a guest. And thank you to everyone who took some time out of your day to listen to the Power Hour. If you enjoyed the podcast, like I always tell you, tell your friends, family, and colleagues to check us out. And don't forget to email us at thepowerhour@heritage.org. Let us know if you want to hear more from Kirk Sorensen. Now, before we end, Kirk, is there anything else you'd like to add? What do you have coming up? Are you on like Twitter and stuff like that? Like where can people find out about you, what you're doing, your company, that sort of thing?
Thanks so much for having me on, Jack. I'd love to do it again. You know, I've been really heads down lately on a lot of stuff. So I don't really do a lot social media anymore, just brutally being honest.
All right. So if people want to hear Kirk, just listen to this podcast and then listen to it again and again and again. You'll be smarter for it.
On our website, we do have a media page. We have lots and lots of interviews and video presentations I've given. I mean, hundreds on there. So if you want to hear me in the past, go crazy. There's a ton there. But in terms of am I actively, you know, tweeting and talking and so forth, not so much anymore.
All right. Well, we got you here and we'll bring you back. Now, John, do you have any final words? What did you think of this whole thing?
I loved it. By the way, great information, great history. And Zach, can I get you to talk to my wife about finances, please?
You don't want me you don't want me talking to your wife about finances. You want my wife to be talking to your wife about finances. Because if it wasn't for my wife, I would be a pauper. I would have a lot of cool stuff. I would be a pauper, my friend.
Okay. Then we'll both be in trouble with that, so forget that. But please, we'll put a link to his website on the show notes. And please subscribe and share.
Absolutely. So there you go, folks. Remember to subscribe, share, email us at thepowerhour@heritage.org. Thank you, John, for being the most awesome producer ever. And Kirk Sorensen, thank you for being an awesome guest. And most importantly, thanks to you all for listening. We'll see you next time.